Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I wanted to start with talking about the Zantac recall and also getting behind that. It's a little bit of a biochemistry lesson, but it's also a lesson in the law of unintended consequences. So we could subtitle what I'm about to talk about is globalism creates new opportunities for product contamination in the pharmaceutical industry. And I was fascinated to read this FDA article. It all starts very early this year, when high levels of a contaminant were found in valsartan, which is a blood pressure medication. And there were multiple batches that were contaminated, and the drug was recalled. And for a while there was a great scramble pulling those. First it was the 120 milligram dose, and then it was this, that, and the other dose, and it was certain lot numbers. And, you know, the system works pretty well for this. But what they were scrambling over was the presence of a carcinogenic chemical, a class of chemicals called nitrosamines. The evil villain here is nitrosodimethylamine, but nitrosamines is kind of a category. And you get nitrosamines when you heat nitrates in the presence of amines. They play well together and they join hands and sing kumbaya, and it shall never further be separated. The problem is this is a highly reactive chemical, which is a known carcinogen. And so nitrosamines are bad in food, but they're even worse in drugs. You can get some nitrosamines just by eating nitrate cured bacon. If you crisp it up, you can get them and other nasty products in barbecue. The problem is that there's lots of nitrates in meat and there's lots of amino acids in meat. So cured meats in particular are notorious for having nitrosamines. But we're not talking about cured meats. We're talking about drugs, something that people take every day with the assumption, and should be a good faith assumption, that our regulatory system is working to keep that as safe as possible. So a few words about this particular nitrosamine. We're going to call this for the future NDMA, because I'm going to get really tired of saying nitrosodimethylamine. So NDMA, not a hallucinogenic substance, although the name is pretty close. This is a potent nitrosamine. It is a known cancer drug, and the valsartan thing happened. The drugs were pulled. We cleaned up the supply, and I didn't think much more about it until recently, in late September. There was a recall of Zantac, which is ranitidine. This is a little more concerning because this is an over-the-counter medication, which means that we can't really track who has it and we can't chase them down. The valsartan, we knew what batch numbers the pharmacies had. We knew which people used which pharmacies. We could trace it and get it out of people's hands and replace their drug. A lot of it, time and energy and money to do that, but that's what we could do. With the Zantac, because it's over the counter, once it leaves the store, there's no way to call it back except to put a all-points bulletin out on the news media and hope people see it. And what happened in late September was that the events with the NDMA in valsartan had caused a lot of online pharmacies and large retailers wholesalers to start testing their drug supplies. And a company that's an online pharmacy called Valisure was doing their own testing, and they found extremely high levels of NDMA in ranitidine products that they were testing. This made a big splash, and the FDA looked at their testing method and said, well, it's actually a testing method that in and of itself has the potential to increase the amount of this compound, so it may not even be present before you test for it. And this is because high heat triggers the formation of NDMA, and if you have a compound that has certain other products in it that are not yet combined and you apply high heat, you may in the process of testing it actually create it. So the FDA has gone back and asked the manufacturers and the suppliers to test their products using a different technology that uses lower heat, closer to human body temperature, and therefore more along the lines of what would happen. And the, all of the other products that have been tested in that method have not shown elevated levels of NMDA. I have seen on the, of course, the oracle of all things, the internet, that people are having trouble finding ranitidine at their local pharmacy. And if I were a pharmacy in the wake of what happened before with the Valsartan, I might go, holy crap, and take away all the ranitidine. I want to emphasize there's lots of other drugs you can take for stomach acid. We'll talk about why maybe you don't need to take drugs for stomach acid as a sidebar to this. But I want to talk a little bit about what the FDA had to say about it. Because it's the day before Halloween, and we might as well get a little bit scared and nervous. And as I reading between the lines on this very dense thing, first point one, the FDA has said there's no acceptable levels of this stuff. The exposures that were seen with the Valsartan are enough to cause one extra case of cancer per 8,000 people. So no, that isn't correctly stated. If you have 8,000 people who get cancer, one of those, you still have 8,001 who get cancer with this. So it is a carcinogen. The amounts that are absorbed are such that not that many people will have been injured, but it's still scary to be using a carcinogen. And goodness sakes, I won't even drink water from plastic bottles except under dire emergencies like airport thirst. And in general, I try to avoid eating any foods that are stored in plastic, particularly if they're oily or heated. So we know that nitrosamine impurities form during the production and of active pharmaceutical ingredients. The FDA calls those APIs. This is your word for the day or your acronym for the day, API. And these active pharmaceutical ingredients form in the process of creating pharmaceuticals. There are things like intermediates that are not purged during steps in the production process, and that's an issue. It's quite difficult to get around. A lot of the problem is contaminated raw materials. These are now sourced all over the planet. Things are no longer made locally. They're made at the place that can make them the cheapest. They're sold on the international market, and they go everywhere. When I was hunting around on the internet for this, I came across an article that was written by the Kuala Lumpur English language newspaper about contamination of Zantac that had shown up in Malaysia. So it's not just a Western problem, it's a global problem because these supplies are now global. A lot of times if the vendor sourced raw materials are contaminated, the person who's making the drug knows that their process for making their particular drug is not capable of forming a nitrosamine, so they will not be testing for nitrosamines. The FDA says if you know that the production series of chemical events has any possibility of making nitrosamine, you have to test for it. You have to test for NDMA. But what if you know that your process has no possibility of making it? Well, you're not required to test. And if some contaminant slips in your raw materials, then that's a problem. I learned in doing the research for this article that recovered materials are a big issue here. So you're using chemicals, solvents, catalysts, all sorts of compounds to do this manufacturing process. So you might put something in a vat of a catalyst, and then once your chemical precipitates, you spin it out of the vat, and then you're going to want to use that solvent again. So you ship it off to a recovery plant that then takes it through a series of subsequent chemical cleansing methods. Like, for example, quenching the materials with nitrous acid. I'm quoting the FDA here, so bear with me. It's written in chemicalese. Subsequent quenching of these materials with nitrous acids to destroy residual azide compounds without adequate removal of the nitrous acid afterwards. Independent recovery facilities may also commingle solvents and catalysts from different customers, or, in other words, so several different companies' solvents and catalysts get put into the same vat for cleaning, and or not perform adequate cleaning of the equipment. So, for example, if you're highly allergic to peanuts and you are highly allergic to them or to gluten, and you eat something where the grinder, let's say in the case of gluten, the grinder grinds wheat, but then they clean it, then they run oats through it. The oats don't naturally contain gluten, but they soak it up from the wheat that went through the same grinder earlier. And so it's a contaminant, but it's a common contaminant. And that's why when you buy oats, if you are celiac, you have to be really careful where you buy them and buy them from a place that never runs them through the same grinder. And in fact, I think Bob's Red Mill is the one outfit I know of, and they don't even use oats and wheat in the same building, because that's one of their, you know, selling points is the purity of their products, and they cannot afford for that not to be true. The problem with this impurities is that because you have so many middle people, you know, making the stuff, recycling the stuff, shipping the stuff, any failure of diligence means that part of a batch of drugs or part of a production line can be contaminated. So part of the best practices that the FDA has introduced, and presumably will come down very hard on you if you don't do it, is you're going to have to check every batch on the back end for NMDA, and you better use a low heat method so that you don't accidentally create a panic, because this could easily happen again. And until they investigate, it's going to be yet another drug scare. It is an extremely important thing to keep the security of our drug supply safe. But I also want to take just a moment before we go to the emails and talk about drug supply in another setting, all right? We've just had our share of power blackouts. We haven't had a fire run through, but, you know, it can happen to you. It can, in fact, happen to you. So I want to give you a little list of things to do over the next few weeks, because I think we should all take a lesson here. The earthquake back in 1989 caused people to start thinking about storing water and maybe a few weeks of a food supply, because they got to experience what it's like when the supply chain gets broken. So that's one thing. But you also need a plan. Your friends, your neighbors, your family members, maybe even, dare I say it, a paper list of contacts just in case you can't get to the directory in your phone. Creating a support network, a phone tree, knowing who's got a landline. And by the way, folks, if you've got a landline, make sure your phone works when the power's off. Go, because a lot of the landline phones cannot pull electricity from the phone line. And you might be the proud owner of a very nice wired phone that plugs into the wall, but if it's not also plugged into an electric outlet, it doesn't work. It's extraordinarily important that you turn off the power in a room, plug a phone into the wall if you are counting on that landline, and see if you've got one. I'm a great fan of landlines. I have had so many power failures where I live that it's just been second nature to me. And I love that comforting dial tone when I pick up the phone when I'm in the middle of a blackout, because I know I can still summon help. This is important, especially as many people have run off the end of their power supply in their phone. And all those apps, all that stuff, it eats batteries. The minute you are in a disaster mode, you really need to think about putting it in battery save mode. and turning off all the social media and that's running in the background, and save your battery. Be prepared for power outages. And if, for goodness sakes, you need a CPAP device, or you need to charge an you have an oxygen concentrator, all these things that take electricity, you need a backup plan. Maybe it's a generator, maybe it's something else, but you need a backup plan. So we've talked emergency numbers, we've talked, think about what's critical for power. Let's talk drugs, because that's what got me rolling on this. You need a list of your medications, dosages, your drug allergies on paper. If you wear glasses, don't throw away your old glasses. They may be scratched up, but they're great spares. You probably need to keep them in a crush-proof case somewhere that you can grab and go. We're talking extra hearing aid batteries, and everybody needs a week's supply of all of their prescription medicines. Sometimes that costs some serious money. Sometimes you can use, say, if you have outdated drugs, this is where they go. They go in your emergency kit. If something outdates, you can get your insurance company to pay to replace it. So never throw away outdated drugs if they are critical medications for you. I completely disagree with that advice. Put them where children can't eat them, but put them where, in a pinch, you can get to them, because most of these things are going to, if they're a pill or a tablet, they're good for 5 years easy, unless they get boiled or burnt. But assuming reasonable storage, you're fine taking an outdated drug. Better 80% functionality than 0% functionality. And by the way, I can't think of a single pharmaceutical that turns poisonous if it outdates. They're not like milk. They just get weaker and less potent. They don't turn toxic. Okay, so transportation, escape route. I think a lot of us are thinking about evacuation plans. Maybe you need to have a backup evacuation plan. Maybe you need to do a reciprocal deal with a neighbor or a family member. And you've got to know how to coordinate. Think about your pets. Think about extra food supply that need for your pets. Maybe they need medications that belongs in your emergency kit. And if you end up in a shelter, where are you going to put your pets? Think about that. Do you have a friend who's out of your area who you could rendezvous with, who would hold on to your dog or your cat for a couple of weeks if you end up having to evacuate? And then just the basic stuff. What would you take camping, right? Maybe you'd take a wind-up weather radio, those little wind-up things with the dynamo in them. You can charge your phone off that too. Charge your phone off your own muscle power. That's not going to go away in a evacuation. Extra batteries, some extra blankets, maybe some actual money. Pretty good thing to have around. Whatever you think you might need, think about it. The stuff that you really need may not be available when you want to resupply. So stock up, think ahead, and stay safe. Okay, and we got a quick suggestion from the floor, and that was go get an old princess-style phone, a landline at a thrift shop. I definitely have seen those at Grey Bears and up at Abbott's Habit. I am a thrift shop queen, and so this is just one little bit of good advice. Those old ones, especially if it has the name of a phone company on the bottom, those will pull power from the phone line. But a lot of people's phones won't do that, so it's extremely important that you figure that out. Basically, if anything's plugging into the wall besides the phone cord, that phone's not going to work in a power failure. So you can still buy those phones brand new also. Looks like my producer checked it out, and they run about $14. Is that right? Okay. He says around $14. That doesn't sound like such a bad idea. So let's go to our first email for the evening. This from JD in San Francisco. Asthma. Hi, I'm going to paraphrase this. It's long, but I'm a woman in my early 40s who was recently diagnosed with moderate persistent asthma, and I now realize I've probably had it my whole life. All that chest pain, headaches, exhaustion I thought were only stress-related were probably asthma. But in March of 2018, this woman came down with a bad cold and started having really severe chest pain. And she apparently embarked upon a real odyssey trying to get people to pay attention to her disease. They looked at her shortness of breath, I guess, and figured that was anxiety. And because her symptoms weren't classic, with chest pain rather than shortness of breath. It took her 9 months to see a pulmonologist and get pulmonary function testing. And then when she finally did get treatment for asthma, she did much better. She realized that she took the first time she took her medication, she was walking from work to her car and was amazed at being able to actually fill her lungs completely. Now, what had been happening with her is that she had a lot of dead space, and we'll talk about dead space in just a moment. I don't hear you talk about asthma much on your show, and I'm wondering what advice and guidance you would offer to someone like me. I'm finally doing much better, but I would love your perspective. So she goes on to tell us that she's on a Breo inhaler, and that is fluticasone, a steroid, and vilanterol, which is a long-acting bronchodilator. And these are the mainstay drugs. She's also taking montelukast, which is a leukotriene inhibitor. So you can think of ibuprofen. It's a COX inhibitor. Well, montelukast is a LOX. So the LOX is the leukotriene. And if you inhibit that, then a bunch of compounds that cause swelling and long-term inflammation in the lungs don't get made. These drugs are also quite effective for allergies. So if you either don't want to take antihistamines or get unacceptable side effects from them, using these leukotriene inhibitors can be a real game changer. And they're just once-a-day drugs, which is nice if you have chronic allergies. She's also taking 5,000 units of vitamin D, some fish oil, some turmeric. She gets acupuncture. By the way, acupuncture works really well for asthma. And I think some of it is the stress reduction, but I also think that it is a neurological loop. Okay. It is spasm. It is a signal being sent to the circular muscles around the airways, causing the muscles to go into spasm. Just to finish up on our emailer, JD, she's also wearing a mask if the air is polluted. That's probably not doing very much. Avoiding her known triggers. She got rid of her cats, uses allergy covers, takes a lot of mucus thinner when she's sick. And she's still wondering about the mind-body connection. And I have to tell you, JD, the mind-body connection in asthma is huge. It's huge in autoimmune disease. It's huge in any kind of hyperimmune condition. So when your immune system is overreactive, anything you can do to calm the brain tends to reduce the immune system hyperreactivity. She also has, oh my goodness, an autoimmune disease, Hashimoto's, and she has allergies and eczema. This is a very, very common thing to have together, allergies, eczema, and asthma. So some of the things that JD is not doing that are in the natural medicine perspective is she's not leveraging her microbiome. So there are products that contain Lactobacillus rhamnosus. This is a particular form of bacteria. Sometimes this is called Lactobacillus GG, but rhamnosus is R-H-A-M-N-O-S-U-S. This particular bacteria is fabulous for calming down the immune system. And I put all of my asthmatics on it, and it really helps them stay in control. It's a calmative for the entire immune system. It says, hey, immune system, chill. There's really nothing going on here, nothing to see. Move along, please. And the immune system, oddly enough, complies. That's because the bacteria have chemical signals that they can send to our gut wall, which can be absorbed by the cells on the gut wall and actually create a cascade of calming influence. It is absolutely amazing. So you should be leveraging that. I would get very thoroughly tested for dietary triggers, and I would tend to avoid large quantities of high histamine food, and you can look up a list of high histamine food. particularly if you have any GI symptoms like occasional random episodes of diarrhea. I think being careful with high histidine, that's the amino acid that the gut can convert into histamine, and then that can be absorbed into your bloodstream and help trigger and worsen allergies. Plus, anybody with eczema, I'm always suspicious of leaky gut, which means that the bacteria that die in your intestine, and there's plenty of dead bacteria, as they break up, little bits of their cell wall called lipopolysaccharides break off. And if you have a leaky gut, they can actually get through intact. And they are like the smell of, they're like the smell of smoke, okay, to the immune system. There's a fire somewhere. We've got to find it. And so you don't want to be arousing the immune system with those lipopolysaccharides. You want to be calming it with a different set of signals coming from the cell wall of different bacteria. And it, and people who have eczema often have developed secondary sensitivities to food, which also acts to keep the whole pot boiling. And we need to calm down the pot, both the kettle, if we will. Shouldn't say pot in Santa Cruz because it will be misunderstood. So we need to turn down the heat under the kettle in any way we can, sending the signals with the lactobacillus rhamnosus, avoiding food antigens, avoiding respiratory antigens, which you're already doing a very good job of, and avoiding toxic thoughts and toxic anxiety. And that's where some sort of biofeedback, I think biofeedback's the best place to start, because if you have anxiety, and JD does, learning to meditate is really difficult. But learning to do what the nice computer tells you to is way easier. And it doesn't have it. It's just your part of your brain learns it without you actually having to will it consciously. All you have to do is sit there and be receptive and breathe. And these biofeedback methods really help. So deep breathing, super important, and now you're doing it. But over a long time, I'd love to see you off the steroids and just on the Montelukast and probiotics with a rescue inhaler. And I think that's probably achievable in most cases of moderate persistent asthma. Maybe not you, because you've had the disease for so long. And the longer you have it, the harder it is to reverse. Not so surprising. What we see in long-term late-stage asthma is we actually see changes in the structure of the lung that we can see with the naked eye. We don't even need we can just look at the section of a lung and we see big overdeveloped muscles around the major airways. And so those, why are they overdeveloped? Because they have been spasming so long, they've become hypertrophic. And the airway will not open all the way up. But I don't think you're that far along from what you're describing. You're thoroughly, thoroughly treatable. Is asthma more common now? It's way more common. And I think one of the statistically well-supported hypotheses for this is antibiotics, because they mess up the microbiome. And certainly breastfeeding has been shown to reduce the incidence of asthma in asthma-prone patients. But if the mother has asthma or allergies, I'm usually giving the baby probiotics or advising it. Mothers are very nervous about doing that. But if you can't let your kid play in the dirt, you can at least give them the bacteria that they should be getting that from you in your milk, even if you're breastfeeding. If they're not in your gut, they have no way of getting in to the kid. And asthma is hereditary at several levels, but one of the levels it's hereditary is that you get your mom's microbiome. And I inherited 4 generations back. There has been bad asthma, bad lung disease in my female line. Guess what? The female line's where you get your microbiome. So I am on permanent microbiome therapy. My asthma's gone. My allergies are gone. So I don't think this is placebo effect. It's just a little too darn real in my view. So both a personal testimonial, and I hope that will be helpful in your moving forward and getting out of your disease state. Our next email comes from Richard in Michigan. I love where he comes from. So I hope this doesn't break confidentiality, but it's Wolverine Lake. It's kind of like Frau Blücher. You want the horse. Wolverine Lake, you want the ow, right? I mean, it's just, it's perfect Halloween email. The rest of it isn't. I'm increasing my activity, watching my diet, keto, but when I mess up, I fast for at least 16 hours to isolate my glucose spike insulin production. Good move there, Richard. This week you mentioned that perhaps taking metformin is actually just fine, but to continue, but what about glyburide? I mostly stopped taking it and thought about stopping the metformin because I brought a glucose ketone meter and I'm usually between 60 to 90 milligrams per deciliter. Obviously, I need to find a healthcare provider that I trust and make an appointment, but I would like to hear your point of view on glyburide as well as general healthy lifestyles. And then he wants to know my opinion about direct primary care. And I think this shows how lower costs and regular care create a lower operating cost with more rewards. I'm not in it yet, but it sounds promising. Yeah, so let's talk about direct primary care because my practice is essentially a variation on that. And direct primary care is code for you are paying a small to medium monthly fee. And with that monthly fee, you're covering part of the doctor's overhead. So it's very expensive, by the way, to bill your insurance. And more doctors are saying, I'm just not going to bill insurance. I'm one of them. Because the amount of staff that I have to bill and track the money I already earned but haven't been paid yet is astronomical. It works out to between 30 and 40% of your overhead, depending on how big your practice is. If it's small, it's more like 40% of your overhead. So that means basically for every dollar you earn, 40% of it is going out of the window just in order to collect. And that's nuts. In direct primary care, patients generally will pay between $25 and $55 a month. It varies from area to area, obviously. And in return for that, they usually get special perks. Among them, they usually have very, very attentive doctors who will respond to questions, maybe even take your calls on their phone immediately or commit to call you back within an hour or so. You have a portal usually, which is a private communication that goes straight to your doctor's desk and they respond quickly. And you have same day or next day service. Usually if you need to get in, you cut yourself, you're bleeding, you don't have to go to urgent care. You call your doctor and they meet you at the office on Saturday afternoon. That's a snapshot of direct primary care. So it's essentially Marcus Welby style medicine in the world of corporate dominated employee physicians where, you can see the doctor in 3 weeks or you can go to the urgent care and those are your options. I think it's a great deal. You get to establish a relationship and often the doctor will actually follow you in the hospital because they maintain their hospital privileges. And here in Santa Cruz County, most of you don't even know this, but if you go to the hospital, your doctor's not coming in to see you. You're going to be taken care of by the hospitalist, which is fine, but it's not your doctor and they don't know your case. And if you're in the hospital for more than a week, you're probably going to see two or maybe three different hospitalists. And these are highly qualified professionals. I am not dissing hospitalists. They're very smart people, but the loss of continuity, I think, can lead to medical errors, and it certainly creates an impersonal quality that gets in the way of healing. And I'm all about the mind-body interaction, so I think it kind of craps on the mind-body interaction. And I've seen people's anxiety level drop when I walk through the door, and it's like, oh, my doctor is here. She's got my back. I trust her. I can relax now. And I can see, I can watch that physical relaxation happen. I can watch it in the family members too. And that is valuable in a healing setting. So now to get back to your question about diabetes, Richard. I'm glad you're doing all the good things. You mentioned keto, and I want to tell you high protein, lots of vegetables, tons of fat. Unless you're going to be really strict about it and not mess up, you're still doing some damage to yourself when you quote-unquote mess up. So I really am more like what they used to call the South Beach diet, where you're eating lean meats and lots of vegetables and staying away from all sugar and starch. And that's the diet I recommend for diabetes. Keto is very good, but it's very hard. And a lot of what people call keto isn't. And I think we're doing some damage to ourselves. Glyburide is a drug I really try to avoid. And I want to tell you about a study. I can't remember the acronym for it now, but it was a big study, and they were trying to test tight control of diabetes. So, you know, good control is 7% hemoglobin A1C. That's considered good control. Tight control would be, you know, below 7%, maybe 6.5 or even 6%. And with most type 2s, you can get there, but you have two or three drugs to get there, because that's how they do it in these studies. They put them on drugs, and then if that's not working, they put them on more drugs until they drive it down to 6.5 or below. And what this study, I think it was maybe ADAPT, A-D-A-P-T, or AMEND, but I honestly don't remember. Someone can let me know, but and I'll tell you when I figure it out. But these studies were large-scale studies, and what they showed was more people died with tight control. So the conclusion that was reached is tight control is bad. But since they were getting their tight control by using drugs, including almost always glyburide or another sulfonylurea drug, you have to take a step back and say, well, what did they die of? Mostly heart disease and congestive heart failure. And what do these drugs do? Well, they actually increase your risk of worsening diabetes. And some of the other drugs that we were using were increasing the risk of heart failure. So we've kind of backed away from those drugs. And the new drugs for diabetes are quite different. They were not studied in these trials. And I think it's an open question whether they would work better and we would see a better patient outcome with aggressive blood glucose management under those circumstances. We'll have to wait for that trial. I'm sure it's going on somewhere. But it takes, you know, 3 to 5 years for these things to get done and for the two groups to diverge, and then another year for you to write up the data. So it's coming, and you can be sure that when it comes, you'll hear it here, and I'll bring you up to date and tell you all about it in an understandable format. In the short run, I have to mention insulin sensitizers that are natural and safe. So I'm going to reel them off real quick. The first one, and probably the most important one, is omega-3 fatty acids. That's fish oil. You know, everyone who listens to me knows I'm a great fan of these. 2,000, 3,000 milligrams of extra fish oil. 6 to 8,000 is probably safe, but if you're on blood thinners or stuff, you really should stop at 2,000. These agents are somewhat mild blood thinners, but they are strong insulin sensitizers, and they shift the curve in the direction of the insulin you're making working better. And type 2 diabetes is primarily insulin resistance, eventually leading to pancreatic failure. It's a progressive situation. I got into an argument with a mathematician the other day, and because he's a mathematician and he reads, he thinks he understands physiology. And I was polite. I want to emphasize, I was polite. But we had to agree to disagree on his interpretation of the meaning of his blood tests. Getting back to this situation, I will just say that omega-3 fatty acids, 2,000 to 4,000 milligrams a day, cinnamon, a quarter teaspoon a day, and that's easy, just throw it in your coffee, alpha-lipoic acid, and chromium, picolinate. So chromium picolinate, about 200 to 300 micrograms, strong insulin sensitizer, and you can find it at the friendly neighborhood health food store. And alpha-lipoic acid, a fabulous drug that reverses neuropathy at doses of 300 twice a day. Very fantastic drug. I use 150 twice a day as my insulin sensitizer dose, and it also protects the liver from fatty deposition. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is a very, very big deal, and more people are getting it because they're insulin resistant. So I hope, Richard, that has helped you, given you some natural foods and some advice. If you can afford it, why don't you sign that DPC contract? Usually there's a cancellation clause. So after 3 to 6 months, if you don't feel you're getting your money's worth, you can always walk away. But you think you'll probably get addicted. So I guess that's a warning. You may end up really liking it. Moving on to another email. This from Oh, lovely name, Jet in Santa Cruz. Jet writes, I have stage 2 melanoma. I'm going to treat this holistically and with diet. The doctor I'm working with is recommending IV mistletoe, among other things. The mistletoe treatments are quite expensive, so I was wondering what your input is on this treatment and if you have an idea of the cost. All right, so I did do, first of all, we'll talk about the cost question. I just Googled it and got a quote of $250 a month for IV mistletoe as it is generally recommended. I could not get a wholesale price. I wasn't able to. I could do that with a phone call, but it was already after 5. So I can't tell you what the cost of the doctor is, but if they're hitting you up for $1,000, go find another doctor because it shouldn't be that expensive. Stage 3 melanoma, just for those of you who don't have the staging memorized. Stage 3 means that you have positive lymph nodes, essentially. Stage 4 means that you have lymph nodes plus a lung or a brain metastasis. But we have early staging where the thickness of the tumor matters in terms of whether chemotherapy is going to be recommended. But if you've got positive nodes, then chemotherapy is being recommended. So before I go any further, I want to tell you that speaking for myself, if I had stage 3 melanoma, I would be lobbying for immunotherapy. There is and this is a conventional medicine treatment. It shows great promise. It turns out you can take your blood and you can pull the T cells, those are the cancer-fighting immune cells, out, and you can sensitize them artificially to your unique melanoma. And I want to remind you that Jimmy Carter had stage 4 melanoma, if I'm not mistaken. But he had advanced melanoma and he was treated with immunotherapy. And of course, he's a past president of the United States. So he got state of the art, fabulous, and he was cured. So I am really enthusiastic about immunotherapy for this particular kind of cancer. And I wouldn't pass it up if I could get it. I would do that. As far as the mistletoe, why not do both? I didn't know a lot about mistletoe, but there's really actually, first of all, you don't want to eat mistletoe. You know, it's berry. It's a parasite. It grows on trees. We put it up at Christmas and kiss under it. But it's not really particularly toxic if you inject it or give it intravenously. There are also studies where they inject it into the tumor. It's toxic to the cancer. And there are many studies showing that it's a good adjuvant in that it reduces side effects. Let's say here's people with advanced metastatic pancreatic cancer. 220 patients receiving supportive care either got mistletoe or nothing. And those who got the mistletoe actually had improved survival and less pain, weight loss, fatigue, nausea, diarrhea, and anxiety. So that was placebo controlled, if you will. Seems like, not placebo controlled because they either were randomized to get it or not get it. I don't think they gave I injected saline. I don't have the study here, so I can't say for sure. But it's pretty decent. There have been studies going all the way back to the 70s. And most importantly, the National Cancer Institute and the FDA says, yeah, this isn't really bad. It's not approved as a treatment for cancer or any other medical condition in the United States, but there have been very few serious side effects. If you take it IV, you're probably going to get some fever and chills. That seems to be the main thing. Another clinical trial showed problems with circulatory problems, maybe some increased risks of thrombophlebitis. And of course, always, because it's a natural compound, a possibility of sensitization. And it does play well with various chemotherapies that it's been tried with. Here's one study that is not promising for you. 830 high-risk melanoma patients received treatment of interferon or mistletoe, and at 8 years follow-up, basically, neither group did any better. So this was a failure to improve study. I guess they were testing out both. The placebo group, basically, and these other two groups had exactly the same. I did find one study published in the Evidence-Based Complementary Alternative Medicine Journal back in 2016, And I will send you the reference for this. You will be interested in reading it. This was not, from a scientific standpoint, a scientific study. It was a survey of doctors who use mistletoe. And these were highly experienced doctors. And their charts were reviewed. And they were interviewed on the care of individual patients. But independent doctors looked at the charts, and they looked at the patient's development of complications, and essentially reached the conclusion that that mistletoe aims to help cancer patients live well with their disease, and they were well tolerated, and the patients improved. Now, it's not placebo controlled, and it's very soft data, so I'm not sure if I would publish it in a journal that has evidence based in its title, but that's a quibble. Overall, I think it's the only real scientific discussion of this beyond a large number of animal and tumor-like culture studies, which do show promise and do show benefit. But the question is always with these things, can you get the IV drug at a high enough dose that you can achieve a high enough level at the tumor to do anything? And nobody's claiming this is going to cure melanoma. And so you're making a decision not to cure your disease. I consider this to be a very aggressive cancer, and I'm just asking you to, you know, reconsider your decision. I think that it would be important to see the other episodes. So I'm going to do something I've never actually done before, but if you're listening to this, and I will send you an invitation back to your email, I will give you a half an hour of my time for free if you bring in your data, and I want all of it. We'll sit down and we'll go over the treatment plan that's being proposed and compare and contrast it to a standard treatment plan. And I'll tell you whether I think what this doctor is suggesting is what I think is going to happen, whether I think it actually stands a chance of curing you, or if maybe that's not your goal. And that's okay too. You don't always have to try to cure your cancer. People can make the decision to just let nature take its course, and I don't have enough background information about you to know whether that's an appropriate decision. So please, I'm not trying to rag on you. I'm just trying to say I don't see this as a path to cure, and I'm very open to alternative medicine, so this is not something that I put down lightly, but I am going to put it down for if that's your intention. Let's go and do the Dr. Don thing. We will pivot to talk about the bacteria and the microbiome because it's cool. A study in humans and mice demonstrates that a fetus has its own microbiome. Communities of bacteria living in the gut, they're known to play important roles. Our study shows that a complex microbiome is transmitted from the mother to the fetus in utero. Let me say that again. We've been talking about, okay, transvaginal transmission. Well, it turns out that the bacteria find their way into the fetus through an alternative route. I'm not sure what that alternative route is. Maybe it's the lymphatics. Certainly it's going to have to go get across the placenta. Who knows? Maybe the bacteria form little tiny liposomes in order to get into the fetus. I would believe anything. Maybe the amniotic fluid gets filled with bacteria, good bacteria, although we've never been able to culture them. If they were gram negatives, those are hard to culture. I'm not sure we've looked for microbial DNA in the amniotic fluid. Sort of an interesting question. When you do an amniocentesis, you got some fluid there. Maybe you should run a check and see if there's bacterial DNA in there. However they're getting in there, it's impressive that they do, and it emphasizes for me the absolute pivotal importance of the microbiome that the body bothers to create a mechanism for the transfer of this across the placenta, which is basically designed to keep bacteria out. So how about that? Also want to tell you about lifestyle and gut bacteria. Remember the Iceman? He lived 53,000 years ago. Some hikers found him at the Austrian Italian border, and there was a little fight about, you know, who had the rights to this frozen corpse. You know, they thought he was a hiker, and he was, but he was a hiker from a long time ago. I wonder what else, as we have global warming and the glaciers retreat, I wonder what other cool stuff is going to turn up in the meltwater. But one of the things about Ötzi, the Iceman, or Ötzi, I guess is the way you would pronounce it, if I got getting my umlaut O correct. Anyway, Ötzi's got a lot of bacteria in his gut, and we can analyze the DNA of that and compare his DNA with the current modern Europeans, and we can look at the prehistoric microbiome. And this study was focusing on Prevotella copri. It's present in about 30% of Western individuals. Normally, the type that is found in Western individuals is just one type. There are four basic clades, and I guess you could think of clades as branches of a family, like you have four children, and then all of their children and grandchildren represent a clade. So closely related, but not identical. Three of the four clades of Prevotella copri are always present in non-Westernized populations. You know, go out to tribal villagers in Africa or South America, they've got all of that. Much less present in Westernized, current Westernized individuals. And obviously, not too surprisingly, the Iceman's guts contained pretty much the same situation as those African tribesmen. And they also found in Mexico some fossilized stool samples, and they were able to do DNA on those. So we can study the evolution of these clades, and we can learn a lot about, among other things, migration of early man. I mean, it's kind of cool that we carry these bacteria along, and they're regionally specific and dietary specific. So I'm finding that extremely cool. And I'm also finding the concept of biofilms extremely cool. So just on the subject of biofilms, we talked about this, I think, briefly last week. The bacteria themselves in the real live humans, you know, the wild type humans, the bacteria are living in biofilms. And what happens in that biofilm determines whether or not bacteria are able to pass on resistance and what kind of resistance they have. And also, we are finding that the biofilm influences whether or not that those bacteria are going to lose their resistance. So I predict that biofilm manipulation as a way of getting around our increasing problem with bacterial resistance is going to be a fruitful area of research. Now that we can basically design vectors with CRISPR, we can basically put any bit of DNA anywhere we want, and with reasonably good targeting accuracy, although not necessarily perfect. But if you're just messing with a bunch of bacteria in a biofilm, probably good enough. Kind of like a shotgun at close range, you're going to hit something. This is a real subject change. AI neural network approach detects heart failure from a single heartbeat with 100% accuracy. Researchers have developed a neural network approach that can identify congestive heart failure with 100% accuracy through the analysis of just one ECG heartbeat. Now, I'm going to tell you that doctors who are experienced cardiologists and who read a lot of EKGs will see, just like you can tell whether something's your father's handwriting or your mother's handwriting, because you've seen them often enough, they can look at an EKG or an ECG and they can say, this is a heart muscle wall under strain. It's called cardiac strain, and it's a change in the shape of the curve. If you can visualize an ECG, it's a pretty straight spike, like a tooth almost poking up. If there's a curve to that spike, that's what's called a cardiac strain. And to the downward part of the curve, you'll also see a change in the slope. And this cardiac strain pattern is something that the human neural network is actually pretty good at picking up, but most of us have gotten lazy. Most of us don't really look carefully at ECGs anymore. We believe the computer. We believe the robot. And Journal of American Medical Association, I think about 6 months ago, published a really interesting review of common computer errors on reading EKGs and what to watch out for, because they make a reliable set of errors due to their programming. And if a doctor's alert to that, you can very quickly data check the interpretation, because if it says it's normal, there's a few things it might miss and you look for those. And if it says it's abnormal, then if it says certain things, you know what to look for to show that, in fact, the machine is wrong. So I know it's hard to believe, but the robot is not always right. And what I'm looking forward to is what they pretty much have in radiology, which is augmented intelligence, where there's a visual processor that looks at the X-ray and points out, take a look here over in quadrant 2J, that looks a little funny to me. That way the doctor it's basically like having a little bit of an autopilot. You don't rely on the autopilot, but it's handy to have around when you need to go to the bathroom. But you're still going to come back and check your headings as soon as you get back into your piloting chair. And that's how we need to approach AI in medicine, in my humble opinion. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.